This episode of Inside EMS Podcast is sponsored by LogRx. Learn a better way to track your narcotics at LogRx.com.
Well, here it is. Once again, it's time to go inside EMS. I am your host, Chris Sabalero, and with me always is the man of the hour, too sweet to be sour. The ladies know he's the man with the power, Kelly Grayson, KG. What's going on with you this lovely week in the middle of spring?
It's good, man. I totally lost my train of thought. This is what happens to me in the middle of spring. I get a turkey hunting brain. I don't concentrate very well.
When is turkey hunting? Does the turkey hunting starts already?
I don't know when it is. It's about now in New York State, but traditionally turkey hunting seasons are in the spring, March and April. And there have been a bunch of them in the yard. And I'm sorely tempted to trek out to the woods and see if I can get a gobbler. But we enjoyed the eclipse last week. That was pretty cool. And, you know, and unlike some dire predictions, it's not the coming of the end times.
Yeah, that was Monday if you didn't have the opportunity to see it.
The people that you know, the conspiracy theorists and the moon bats that put so much into this and just breathlessly share this on social media are a never-ending source of amusement for me and dismay that the human species is becoming that friggin' stupid. But, yeah.
Well, I mean, I think it's just belief, man. And, you know, but I've been through a couple of eclipses in my life, and it gets to be a little, you know, it's something great that people who haven't experienced it since the last one, you know, had the opportunity. But I think we got a really great topic to bring in this week. And I think you're going to lead this discussion. Yeah. Usually I'm kind of taking us down the discussion path, but, you know, you want to talk about the bias cascade. And I think that, you know, it is part of the, you know, the way that we do our business personally and professionally, that sometimes, Kelly, we make a decision and now has a collective tolerance, and that decision now snowballs to get to a point where maybe it wasn't the right decision, but I'll let you set it up for the listeners.
Well, this all came about critiquing one of my students in IV starts. He's a military medic, a 68 whiskey, and he's a little sloppy on some things, or at the time he was. He's gotten much better now. And he stuck a unclean IV on the mannequin. And I critiqued him for it, and he just shrugged it off. Said, "Well, I can always give her antibiotics." And we had to go into a long discussion on how sticking a dirty IV in an otherwise healthy 25-year-old male in great physical condition is a different thing than sticking a dirty IV in a fragile little old grandma who maybe not can tolerate that little simple mistake. You know, and I say, okay, so she gets her antibiotics, and those antibiotics cause C. diff diarrhea, and she gets profoundly dehydrated from that, and her kidney function isn't all that good in the first place. And not only is she severely dehydrated, she's got severe electrolyte imbalances, and she's on beta blockers, so she can't really make up for the loss of volume with increased heart rate, and she winds up becoming unstable and codes and so on and so forth. And I said, this is a series of unfortunate events that doesn't necessarily have to happen by the simple expedient of taking your alcohol prep and swabbing that site again if you've touched it since you did it the last time. And to make that point with him. But it got me to thinking about different instances of compounding error in EMS that I've seen in my career and that still go on today, where one small little mistake leads to a series of unfortunate events. And that's what I'm going to call the article in the subsequent conference lecture on, a series of unfortunate events that has devastating consequences for the patient. You ever had such an event happen to you?
One of the ones that I think that stick with me is, you know, I made a mistake that I don't know that it was really, and maybe correct me if it wasn't a cascade, but I arrived on scene at a rehab hospital where the doctor told me that a woman had a stroke and she needed to go over to the local hospital for treatment. She had an IV in place. She went in for a knee replacement. And one of the things that I did was treated the stroke and went down the stroke protocol, only later to find out that a couple hours later that the nurse came in and accidentally gave her insulin that was meant for the lady in the next bed. And I didn't do a D-stick. I didn't do all the things that you know. So really my decisions didn't get her worse, but my lack of decision didn't give her the relief, you know, the care that she did. I don't know if that fits into this cascade bias, but that sent me down a path of doing something other than what I should have done, knowing better. And I got to tell you, Kelly, at the time, I was probably a 15-year paramedic when I made that mistake.
And that's the insidious part about some of these. The bias cascade is the more respected and trusted the initial person with the bias, the more this is likely to happen. Because when Joe Blow, who is wrong just as often as he's right, brings in a patient to the ER staff knows to check behind them, you know, and not to trust what they say. But when Chris Ceballero comes in and the ER staff knows and knows your skills and knowledge, they go, oh, well, okay. So, and they operate on what may be a false premise. I experienced a compounding error similar to this. It's happened to me with mistakes I made early in my career. And those are long-winded tales, but I remember one in particular where I was working as a paramedic in the ER. And one of the local paramedics brought in a patient from a minor motor vehicle accident. And this is when when spinal clearance in the fields first started to take off, and many, many agencies were updating their protocols on spinal clearance in the field. And this paramedic was one of those holdouts who's, you know, I've seen it save lives. So they get a minor MVC, and there is a very tall man, 6'6", 400 pounds, who's walking around ambulatory at the scene. But he's a little banged up, and he requests the ambulance to bring him to the hospital to check him out. And the guy said, okay, we're going to have to put you on a board. And the guy said, man, I've had a gastric bypass. I cannot lay flat. I will vomit. I know it. I can't do it. And the guy said, quote, if you want to go to the hospital in my ambulance, you're going to go on a board. So the guy acquiesced to it. Paramedic did a standing takedown, immobilized him on the board, and predictably the guy vomited en route to the hospital 5 minutes out, and he aspirated some of his stomach contents and got to the hospital, and the paramedic had suctioned him out. The guy was still, he was in some degree of distress. He aspirated a good bit and wound up getting hypoxic coating later in the ER. And we resuscitated him after a lengthy resuscitation with anoxic brain injury. And the guy was discharged to a nursing home and died 2 months later from sepsis from a bed sore, which none of that cascade of events would have happened if the paramedic had thought, you know what, you're walking around, this mechanism was fairly minor, I'm pretty sure your neck's not broken, and this is a good instance where I could use my clinical judgment and say, okay, spinal mobilization is not necessary. But that one decision eventually killed that poor man. And that's the kind of thing that goes on. And sometimes we don't see the end results of it because we get such poor and limited feedback from the hospital once we've brought the patient in. But this notion of compounding error and bias cascade is something that I think is kind of underappreciated in EMS, and we don't see the ramifications of it in many of our patients.
Yeah. So when we think about this, then, you know, from your side, and this is really kind of a new area for me to, you know, chat about. So I want to, you know, take it from the side of picking your brain about what it means and how do we go against this? I mean, so, but sometimes we make decisions, and it's hard to quantify this. Sometimes we make decisions that we don't mean to do any harm, or we don't mean to do anything wrong. As you said, we're using our clinical judgment to flip a coin and say, you know, this is where we're going to go, which may now send the cascade of events that get to the end. But we may not know when this is going on, Kelly, and we may not know that the decisions we're making may later on cause challenges. So how do we define this as far as saying, should I really do this?
I wrote long ago that the more I learn and the better I get knowledge-wise as a paramedic, the more knowledge I gain, the less I am likely to do to a patient, you know, the more I practice restraint.
I don't understand that comment.
The more I learn, the less I do.
Okay. So basically I don't need to start an IV here, or I don't need to, Okay.
Or that sort of thing, you know, where CPAP and CHF exacerbation, acute pulmonary edema, and that thing. You remember back in the day, we would have tubed that patient right then, or sedated them and tubed them if necessary, because that was what we did.
Yeah.
Ignorant of the fact that 25% of these patients that we tubed wind up with ventilator-associated pneumonia, cost the hospital in addition to the cost of their care, which is usually far more than the reimbursement. They also get ventilator-associated pneumonia, which is considered a never event under the Affordable Care Act. And that additional $50,000 of treatment is sunk cost to the hospital. And these patients are more likely to die, even if we intubated them correctly and smoothly the first time. So there's an example of these kind of things that we thought we were doing good, but we actually weren't. And it takes some coordination with the hospital and a robust QA and feedback mechanism and follow up on these patients that many EMS services, even in 2024, still don't have. You know, you're old enough to remember when we gave sublingual procardia to stroke patients, right? You know, and how many of us in EMS actually see that stroke patient after we dropped him off at the hospital? None, never. Unless he's admitted or he or she's admitted to a nursing home later and you deal with the aftermath then. But we didn't realize how much we were compromising cerebral perfusion by lowering the blood pressure. Good. You know, hey, the blood pressure is high. It probably caused a stroke. We need to lower their blood pressure, ignorant of the physiology of it. And we didn't see the long-term effects. And that's just another example of it. And I had this conversation with a number of my paramedic students, because in this system up here, it's things haven't been good for a while. And in the North Country and in New York, massive staffing shortages, heavily volunteer, and the volunteers always have been the canary in the coal mine when it comes to staffing problems. And when you can't even get volunteers, things get even worse. They're a harbinger of things to come in the paid side of EMS. And as a result, because every agency is desperate to put meat in the seat, things go ignored and unnoticed that would not have flown in other agencies. And I keep saying, I'm continually amazed by some of the things I see happen up here. And I go, you know, I hate to say, you know, my old agency or where I'm from, this wouldn't work. I don't want to be that guy. But there are things that some medics get away with up here that would have gotten you fired on the first offense if that happened anywhere else in the country. And the insidious thing about it is most of these EMTs and paramedics, this is the only version of EMS they've ever experienced. They think that's is how it's supposed to be. So I had an engineer in the class, and we talked about tolerance stacking. If you're unfamiliar with tolerance stacking, is it's in engineering, if you know math matters, and one small little error in tolerance can compound to the point where the machine fails because of all of these errors in tolerance that build on the next step in the process. And the analogy I painted for the students is, you know, just because things have been crappy for a long, long time doesn't mean that crappy is the way it's supposed to be. And this is just another example of this cascade of compounding errors where one small little mistake or one small little thing that you let go because you're shorthanded turns into eventually a culture that is just rotten to the core in some of these agencies.
And now let's pause for a word from our sponsor.
Designed and founded by EMS professionals, LogRx provides real-time accountability of all your narcotics from cradle to grave. Reach out today for a demo and download the app on the iTunes and Google Play stores. And coming soon, LogRx will also track your medical supplies, equipment, PPE, and even vehicle checks. For more information, visit logrx.com. That's LogRx.com.
Let's go to the psychology then. So you and I have debated on many, many occasions over our decade. Protocols are only guidelines that we should be able to use our knowledge. We should be able to use our skills and ability to make the best decisions for the patient. So now when we start to think about this from a cascade or a bias cascade or cascade bias, whatever you want to call it, Sometimes if we're going to make decisions, how do we now mitigate the fact of we may make a decision that now puts us
That's right.
down this cascade that, you know, so it almost seems like a double-edged sword here. Don't just follow your protocols, do what's best for the patient. Oh my God, I did what's best for the patient and I wound up giving him anoxic brain injury.
I think one of the things you have to do is continually reevaluate your patient and your decision-making paradigm. And the more sure you are, and the more experienced you are in making those decisions, the more you have to do this, because people who are unsure of their decision-making paradigm and unsure of what the diagnosis should be or the next step should be are constantly questioning themselves. And this is where confidence kills us sometimes. It's because we're fairly sure in it. We, you know, our sense of pattern recognition has gotten really, really good, and we're not often aware of the times when we are wrong. They may be fairly uncommon, maybe even rare, but when they do happen, they can have really, really big consequences. So the concept I teach is in reassessment is John Boyd's OODA loop. If you're familiar with the OODA loop, it was a decision-making paradigm that Air Force Colonel John Boyd developed for the tactical decisions that fighter pilots make in dogfights. And the guy was like undefeated. He waxed everybody he flew against. And his decision-making paradigm came to be known as the OODA loop: observe, orient, decide, act. And I teach this stuff to the students as well, because you cannot go into a call with implicit bias or bias in your mind. And that bias could come from the dispatch information. It could start the moment you get in the truck before you've ever seen the patient. Dispatch tells you you're going to this kind of call, and you trust that information, and everything is filtered through that lens once you arrive at the scene. So in the OODA loop, I just tell people that never move faster than your brain can operate, and don't just do something, stand there. That 10 seconds in the doorway at the beginning of the call is all important. You go in, you take scope of the situation, that global survey, you decide, okay, you observe, you orient yourself to what you think the particular problem is, and that look test we all know for experienced medics is pretty powerful. Then you decide what needs to be done, and then you act upon that decision. And once that decision or that act has been done, then you reorient yourself. Did that work? Was that the right decision? What do I need to do now? That's your next decision. Then you act upon that and you reorient yourself. And I think back on times in my career where I've screwed people up. If I'd have just gone back and looked at my initial decision and looked at, okay, does everything fit what I thought was wrong with the patient? I wouldn't have killed that patient. For example, had a patient that I killed. We got him back, thank you. But I killed him because I was totally oblivious and disbelieving of the potential for someone being profoundly hypothermic in August in Louisiana in 102 degree ambient temperatures. But it happened. A very skinny, chronically ill male was out mowing his yard, came inside, complained of weakness and dizziness, and passed out. And his family said, "Oh my God, he's overheated. Let's cool him off." So they stripped him down naked, put him in the cold, cold shower, and ran cold shower water on him for 20 minutes, and took him out of the shower, laid him on his bed underneath the ceiling fan in front of a air conditioner in Louisiana, turned on full blast like they are. And I get there and I find this thin, extremely pale, extremely cold person on the bed with a little puddle of coffee ground emesis on the mattress in front of him. And I thought, oh my God, this guy's got the GI bleed of all GI bleeds. He's already shocky. I need to move with this. So I took this guy, put him in my ambulance, started two large bore IVs, proceeded to dump 2 liters of 72 degree fluid into him, you know, and it's hot, and I don't like to sweat. So I didn't even keep the air conditioner on, didn't even really bother to cover him all that much. That was a big mistake. Still not getting better. I check his blood sugar. It's like, why is this guy not improving with all this fluid should have worked for shock. And this is before we practiced permissive hypotension. So I check his blood sugar. His blood sugar is 50. Okay, maybe he's hypoglycemic. And I give him an ampoD50. And ultimately, I wind up arriving at the hospital and had to give the report you never like to give. I've done all these things, and I don't know what's wrong with this guy. I have no idea, even at this point. So we moved him from our stretcher to the telemetry bed and shook him real hard, jostled him, and the dude went into VFib. They hustled
Wow.
him to a treatment room. They hustled him into a treatment room. And 10 minutes into the resuscitation, the ER doc came out and gave me this withering look and said, "Do you know what that guy's core temperature was?"
Hypothermia.
Yeah. And I said, "No, sir, I don't. But since you're asking me that question, I'm going to guess it was pretty damn bad." And he said, "It was 82 degrees." And I went, "Oh, now it's all clear."
But that wasn't your fault, though. I mean, you
and
went
they
down the
coded the
path.
guy.
You went down the path to kind of figure out what was wrong. I mean, so I don't know that that was a cascade bias as
Well,
much as it
because
was a.
I ignored, I made assumptions. He's cold. He's clammy. He's got coffee ground emesis. He did happen to have a GI bleed. It was a fairly minor GI bleed, but coffee ground emesis, cold, clammy, hypotensive. Oh my God, he's in decompensated shock. And his heart rate was 56. And instead of saying, "Wait, one of these things is not like the other," I assumed, "Oh my God, he's on his way down. His heart rate's already starting to climb. The next heart rate I'm going to get is zero." And as it turned out, it did wind up being zero, but not for the reason I thought. So it's one of the things that you need to think of before we close is if you are sure, always consider the possibility that you might be wrong and go back and reevaluate your decision-making paradigm. Maybe use that OODA loop that we talked about. You do that, and you have a chance of catching errors before they become big errors that wind up killing the patient. But hey, that's what we think. We'd like to hear what you think. Can you think of some instances in your career where compounding error and bias cascade has resulted in the harm of a patient? We'd like to know about those. Email us at the show at EMS1.com. Don't forget to rate us on iTunes. And for myself and co-host Chris Sebalero, thanks for tuning in to Inside EMS. Going to catch you guys next week.